fits to him, he describes. He says, he knew, while he knew that my position to Khilafat is the position of the axis in relation to the handmill. The problem is, you know, this generation doesn't know what is a handmill. They have grinders at home, you know, all electrical. But just about 50 years ago, if people wanted to grind things, they would have this handmill at home. And this is how you get flour and other things. But for those two stones to work together, you needed a pole in the middle. And the stone at the top will have a hole in there, which you will fix on it, and then you will be able to move the stone on the top over the bottom. Otherwise, they will not really go together. It will not work properly. It will fall off. And this is what Amir al-Mu'mineen says. If you look at Khilafat, if that handmill is the Khilafat, that pole in between, that's the Qutb. And that's me. The system of leadership and Khilafat of Islam, he says, I am there, in middle there. If you don't have it that, the system will not work properly. And this is where he says, and then, you know, after describing that, I am the central part of the system of Khilafat. Without me, it will not work.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
I'm one of the Omidvar brothers. My name is Isa Omidvar. My brother Abdullah is now living in Chile. For 10 years, we traveled around the globe to study various primitive societies and places off the beaten track. Our desire to travel had roots in our childhood. Our family was made up of 4 brothers and 2 sisters. Our mother loved traveling. We would go on long journeys when we were still little children. At that time, going to cities like Qom or Mashhad was considered long journeys. We used to attend Iqbal High School here. It was right here. It must be here. You know, people live with their memories, especially with the memories of their own town. I joined the climbing organization when I was in my early teens. Along with my friends, I would discover all big caves in the country. Inside these caves, we would find things that belonged to the past, things like swords, oil lamps, and so on and so forth. Now they are all kept at the museum. Things like skulls. Things like these kept us motivated. So little by little, we developed a desire to know more about primitive people and their lives. We wanted to go to their lands, meet them face to face, and study their lives more seriously. As two teenage boys, Abdullah and I decided to travel with Iranian nomadic tribes to get more experience. We also wrote for many Iranian journals. So after 3 years of studying and exploring, we finally got prepared for our longest journey. In 1954, we imported two motorbikes from the UK. به وسیله دو تا موتورسیکلت که از انگلستان وارد کردیم ما اینها رو باز کردیم و خیلی تغییراتی هم درش دادیم ساکای بزرگی We put big sacks on them and installed a big reserve gas tank in the back of one of them. We put all our equipment in the sacks.
ما وسایلمون تجهیزاتمون داخل این توبره ها میذاشتیم و اینا و خیلی مجهز شد. موتورسیکلت ها برای یه
The motorbikes were not for racing, though. They were to accompany us in a long odyssey. Fifteen years ago, when I came here, our former house, which was an old building, extended from here to the end of that building. It had a ceiling made of mud. But now you see what's happened to it. We were here during World War II. We were born in that house. It was located in the most ancient part of Tehran. The night before our journey, our father gave us 100 tumans and told us, I'll telegraph a friend in Mashhad to help you if necessary. After riding 300 kilometers, the handlebar of my motorbike broke. With great difficulty, we got to an abandoned coffee shop. I tried then to fix it up. Abdullah also remained there. Though we were only 300 kilometers away from Tehran, we didn't come back to the city. We didn't want to look behind. The city would begin from this point towards the east. Only this district was a bit towards the west. Our father's shop used to be over there. There was also a travel agency there with a big garage at the back of the building. There used to be about 10 old buses for traveling across the country. The buses had windows of wire rather than glass. I used to come here whenever I could and watch the travelers on the buses, dreaming about going to faraway lands.
ما
We had a comprehensive plan. We moved from Tehran toward the east, we went to Afghanistan, and passed through cities like Herat, Kandahar, and Kabul. We stayed in Kabul for a week, performing some programs there. Then we headed for Pakistan, visiting Lahore, Karachi, Ceylon, Hyderabad, and finally Madras. We continued our journey until we reached Delhi. There we met with Nehru, the Prime Minister of the time. We asked him to let us go to the northeast part of India. Our aim was going to Tibet. We climbed a mountain in the Himalayas. Actually, our goal was not only climbing, but also finding a way to go to Tibet. Those days, the Tibetans didn't allow any foreigners to visit their land. Anyway, we came back to India and visited the whole Far East. From Jakarta, we went by sea to the east of Australia. We organized a program there about Aborigines. We lived with them for a while. We remained in Australia for about 9 months. It was our first encounter with the Aborigines, the real inhabitants of Australia. I found the Aborigines tribes very interesting. They believed that man had been evolved from creatures like fish, crocodiles, and kangaroos, and that all human beings are members of a big family. After traveling across Australia, we came back to Asia, this time to Japan. We stayed in the country for a month. We visited Hokkaido in the north. Then, with a fishing boat, we went from this way to here, the Aleutian Islands in South Alaska. In other words, we went to North America. From there, we went to Alaska and equipped ourselves for the Arctic Circle in Alaska. It was the year 1958 when we were in North America. We lived about 7 months among the Inuit in the North Pole. The temperature was between 60 and 65 degrees below zero centigrade. We had to adjust our cameras so as to make them suitable for cold weather in the North Pole. Otherwise, they wouldn't work properly. We also had to figure out some solutions for the films, which would be fragile in sub-zero temperature. Our aim was not just to visit the Inuit and take some photos of them. Our main aim was to examine their way of life. In the North Pole, we traveled to different areas in the summer and winter. It was unbearably difficult to be there in winter. We lived with the Inuit inside igloos. Many times we traveled with the Inuit, which gave us a better understanding of their lives. We sledged hundreds of kilometers with their families and hunters. The sledges would be pulled by 7 or 9 dogs.
خانوادگی یا ما به اتفاق شکارچیا سفر می‌کردیم روی
We sledged over the snow in northern parts of the Hudson Gulf and Victoria Island with their very harsh conditions.
شرایط بسیار دشواری داشت. اسکیمو‌ها ببینید هر جا می‌رسن
It's very easy for the Inuit to build their houses, igloos that is. It takes them just an hour to build an igloo. Usually in every house, 2 families live together. They also build a porch attached to the igloo to prevent wind from coming directly inside. They also put their weapons and the hunted animals in the porch. In fact, the Inuit live in very hard conditions. They are not aggressive people. They are not dangerous at all. Since they have to live in harsh conditions, they need each other's help. They are very close to each other. They build their igloos near each other. Sometimes the frozen sea the igloos were built on would break to pieces and the Inuit needed each other's help. What you see is one of our motorbikes and the car we used when traveling. We had 2 motorbikes, but now just one of them has remained. For 7 years, we traveled with this motorbike. It was not easy to travel with it. We imported it from England in 1954. The bikes were in a box. We opened the box and assembled them. We also added our own equipment to the bikes. We kept things for filming and photography inside that box. In our backpacks, there were photos of Iran's historical works. We took those photos with us to hold exhibitions in big cities around the world.
تاریخی و هنری ایران در شهرهای بزرگ دنیا یعنی انگیزه ما برای ادامه کارهامون خیلی خیلی قوی بود
We were very motivated to continue our job. Nothing was important for us except for our goal. We would put our equipment on top of that. One of the motorbikes had a reserve gas tank that could contain gas up to 30 liters. To share our duties, I filmed and took photos. My brother is a good orator. He's also very good at note-taking. So during our journey, he kept a diary.
خیلی قویه در صحبت کردن و یادداشت‌هامون رو بیشتر ایشون می‌نوشت، یادداشت‌های روزانه‌مون. ما هزینه سفرمون رو ضمن مسافرت خودمون تامین می‌کردیم. من
As we were traveling, we would earn money to afford the cost of traveling. For example, I would catch poisonous snakes and sell their poisons to pharmaceutical institutes. Sometimes we had to make a living out of poison. We also wrote for the world's famous magazines based on our studies and research. We wrote many articles for prestigious European magazines in Europe like Bonte Deutsch, Connaissance des Mondes, Sans Voyage, and National Geography. We would also take part in TV programs. When we were in cities, we would be invited by universities. There, we would be provided with food and a place to stay, all free of charge. There, we were also allowed to use film and photography laboratories to develop our photos. We are all part of the international community. We are all different, but we are all of the same origin. We must bear in mind that we are originally the same, but we have been separated from each other for political reasons. If I'm reborn, I'll do the same thing again. But I know that all different communities, once we lived with, have disappeared completely. I personally like the Far East more than other places. We have many cultural similarities with those in the Far East. After that, I prefer Latin America with its friendly people. We and the Latinos are very similar in general. That's why my brother is now living in Chile. I always tell the Iranian young people to move. If a pen doesn't move, it can write nothing. A river is clean because it moves. The same is true about man. The more one moves, the more one travels, the more one studies, he would lead a better life. With traveling, you would have a better life.
bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
On World Water Day, the international community must not forget Palestinians living under Israeli regime occupation, whose access to clean water is severely restricted. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. According to Middle East Eye, the seizure of water to drive people from their land has long served as a tool of colonial domination. That process is well advanced in the occupied West Bank, where water has been controlled by the Zionist regime since its occupation began in 1967. While Arlikir 40 of the 1995 Oslo Second Interim Agreement between the Zionist regime and Palestinians set up a joint water committee, the Zionist regime retained veto power over all Palestinian water proposals, and no constraints were placed on the amount of water it could take from occupied Palestinian territory. In 2013, the Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq analyzed the Zionist regime's discriminatory water practices as water apartheid. Its Water for One People Only report details how Israel's command of water resources in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip promotes the displacement of the Palestinian population and represents only one element of an irreversible structural process that can only be described as colonial. The Zionist regime's discriminatory water policies, which enable it to extract for its own use and that of its settlements some 90% of the water from the West Bank's mountain aquifer, and which deprive Palestinians of sufficient water for agriculture and their basic needs, are a focus of the two well-researched reports on Israeli apartheid produced in 2022 by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, HRW. These reports join many others produced over the past two decades by Palestinian and Israeli organizations, UN bodies, the World Bank, NGOs, journalists, and scholars that describe how constraints imposed by military orders are steadily forcing Palestinian farmers from the 62% of the West Bank known as Area C. Farmers are prevented from drilling new wells or improving old ones, installing pumps, and even collecting rainwater, where their springs are seized and their water tanks, cisterns, and pipelines destroyed, while settlements and roads serving Eretz Israel are erected on their agricultural land. Israeli settlers consume six times the amount of water permitted to their Palestinian neighbors, who are forced to purchase expensive water extracted from the West Bank by Mekorot, the Israeli national water carrier in order to overcome shortfalls in water allocation and frequent water shutoffs. The Zionist regime's weaponization of water for the benefit of settlers and de facto annexation can be regarded as a long-standing practice of settler colonialism. But how can one explain Israel's water policies in the Gaza Strip, one of the most densely populated places on Earth, where the Zionist regime evacuated its 21 settlements in 2005? Since then, Gazans have no longer experienced Israel's military occupation as the steady takeover of land. Instead, they have confronted an existential threat to their health and lives that Israeli historian Ilan Pepe, among others, has called incremental genocide. Some Israeli human rights lawyers firmly reject this application of the term, but water is life. And the impact of the Zionist regime's nearly 16-year-long blockade and five major military offensives on the severely limited clean water supply available for a rapidly growing population, half of them children, has raised questions about whether the Gaza Strip remains a livable place, to use the UN's phrase. The Israeli blockade has destroyed Gaza's economy and led HRW to refer to the Gaza Strip as an open-air prison. Its population is trapped within walls and fences and below constant drone surveillance, while the fabricated regime of Israel exerts tight control over all movement of goods and people by land and sea, and from time to time engages in lethal mowing the grass military operations, but makes no attempt to reach a political solution. By 2021, half of the population of the impoverished Gaza Strip was unemployed. Gaza has only one source of renewable fresh water. The coastal aquifer, stretching from the northern occupied territories to the northern Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. Along with the aquifers beneath the West Bank, the coastal aquifer has been under total Israeli control since the occupation began. According to a 2013 UN study, the Zionist regime extracts 66% of water of the coastal aquifer, while the Gaza Strip extracts 23% and Egypt 11%. The arrival in Gaza of hundreds of thousands of refugees from what is now called the fabricated regime of Israel put heavy pressure on the aquifer, and within decades, residents were extracting more water than could be replenished annually. In the period 1995 to 2011, water extraction increased more than 30%, causing a decline in the level of the aquifer that allowed sea water to leach in. The Zionist regime's deep wells, boreholes adjacent to Gaza, and dams have further impacted Gaza's water availability. The UN, in its August 2012 report, stated that the aquifer might be irreversibly damaged by 2020 without a 60% increase in Gaza's water supply. The World Bank cited an alarming and worsening situation in Gaza over the 2010-16 period and found that by 2016, access to improved drinking water in Gaza was close to zero. By 2020, Gazans were still getting over 95% of their water from the polluted aquifer and extracting three times its sustainable yield, with more than a third lost because of the decrepit infrastructure. Approximately 97% of that groundwater was unfit to drink due to high sewage and salinity levels. Gaza's remaining supply was produced by small, unregulated desalination plants, 2.6%, and 2% was purchased from the Israeli National Water Company, Mekorot, by the cash-strapped Palestinian Water Authority. An environmental assessment published in 2020 was particularly bleak. It found the coastal aquifer had been reduced to 10 meters below sea level, while only 55 to 60 million cubic meters could safely be taken from the aquifer. Some 160 to 200 MEM were being extracted each year. Municipalities were only able to meet 80% of the residents' water needs, and pipe water failed to reach homes for days at a time. The shortage of clean water is only one part of the problem. The cost of purchasing often polluted trucked water is prohibitive for many Gazans, half of whom live below the poverty line. The water they consume is well below 100 liters per day standard for per capita domestic needs set by the World Health Organization. According to a press release issued by the Palestinian Bureau of Statistics and the Palestinian Water Authority on World Water Day, the daily per capita allocation of water for domestic use in Gaza is 86.6 liters per day. However, water suitable for human use amounts to only 26.8 liters daily. Mekorot puts Israeli per capita consumption of clean water at 230 liters per day.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about, in fact, some of the rules related to fasting and Ramadan, since we are in the month of mercy, in the month of barakah, and in the month of Ramadan. So we're going to deal with this, in fact, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei.
He was born in 1939. When he began his Hausa studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules about fasting and Ramadan, in fact, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, in the previous episodes, when we started a series of episodes related to the month of Ramadan and fasting, you explained to us and elaborated on the age of legal responsibility before. And you made it abundantly clear in the previous episode for the girls, for example. You said the age of the Sharia puberty, in fact, is about 9 lunar years. And for the boys, actually, it's 15 lunar years. But my question to you is that about a 9-year-old girl, all right? We all know that it's obligatory for her, in fact, to fast, right?
Yes.
If everything goes according to plan, I mean, like, everything is okay, right? About the health of this girl and so on and so forth. The question is that if she breaks her fasting because it becomes very hard for her, you know, what should she do now? I mean, like, does she have to perform the qada of the fast?
Well, let's understand that, okay, yes, sometimes a girl may be under the assumption or the impression that, okay, fasting is hard, let's, you know, stop fasting, or let's not fast because it's hard. Okay, in that case, it's not an excuse, okay? She must give a penalty, she must atone for it, and also she should observe the qada of the fast. But if fasting proves to be extremely hard and very difficult, of course, there's only qada of the fast and there's no kafara to be paid by her.
Yes, I see.
That is.
Okay, and you know, if somebody has a strong excuse, like,
yes,
doubted, for example, for 50% of probability that fasting was obligatory for that particular individual, all right?
Yes.
So he did not fast then.
Yes.
All right? Because of the strong excuse that the individual had. But later it became clear to him, all right, that fasting was obligatory for him, all right?
Yes.
At that time then. So what's the jurisprudential law about this issue, and especially when it comes to performing the qadha, and if there is any kafara to pay for?
Okay, good. Well, if a person breaks a fast in the month of Ramadan merely due to the possibility that fasting is not obligatory for him, and he is under such an impression, just as I said in my answer to the previous question, he must carry out the qaza and pay the expiation or the kafara as well. But in fact, if a person did not fast out of a rational fear, a genuine rational fear that fasting would be harmful for him, and the continuation of not eating or drinking something might actually lead to a kind of complication, health complication, or it may actually, in fact, worsen his poor state of health,
mm-hmm.
then, of course, it's not necessary for him to pay kafara, but he must perform the qadha. And I think there is an explanation. I did explain in the previous episode that if a person's health is worsening, a person is already suffering from a poor state of health,
mm-hmm.
Let's say an illness, okay, and if that illness continues until the next Ramadan, then there is no qadha. And of course, if he recovers any time before the next month of Ramadan, he has to make up the fast, and there is no penalty, there is no kafara to be paid by him.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammed Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. The topic is still fasting and Ramadan, and some of the laws related to this holy month with Sheikh Javid. I'm going to ask you about military service, a soldier doing the military service at a particular station or base or garrison where it involves a lot of traveling or frequent traveling and, you know, going here and there, and of course doing whatever that the soldiers do, you know. And then the person did not fast, that
sure.
soldier, all right?
Yes.
And then there was another Ramadan again, and he's still serving at the same area, all right?
Yes.
In the same area. And then didn't fast either, well, during that year again, or Ramadan.
Yes.
So the question is that does he have to pay the kafara after leaving, for example, the military service or finishing it? What about the qadha of those fasts?
Well, you know, being in the place of military service, or being working as a
conscript, let's say someone who has been conscripted by the military, and of course he has to work at a military base, not elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not an excuse to justify not fasting. So a person as a soldier must also fast, and he should, if he, in the event that he considers it as an excuse and breaks his fast, of course he should fast. He should make up for the missed fast, and he should give up. He should give the qada and also give kafara as well, because he did not. He broke his fast without a proper justification or without a proper excuse. So, of course, in the event that a person does not perform the qada until the next Ramadan, then there is another kind of expiation or another kind of kafara which he has to pay, and that's called the kafara of ta'khir, kafara of delaying the mm-hmm. qada.
Yes.
Because one has to pay the kafara until the next Ramadan, and when a person fails, he should give the kafara for delaying, which is of course 750 grams of foodstuff for each day, and that kafara should be given to poor Shia Muslims,
mm-hmm.
and not to any poor people who are out there in the street, because some are non-Muslims, and of course the Shia Muslims are the first priority should be given to poor and needy Shia Muslims, and there are many poor Shia Muslims.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, you said 750 grams of what? Wheat or rice or what?
It can be anything, like like bread, like flour, like rice, meat, noodles, and anything which is considered to be food in common view.
Yes, of course, in its currency, right? Like you can give the money of the same amount, right?
And the money is money can be given, provided that one makes sure that the recipient will use the money to buy food, okay? Mm-hmm. And if he's going to buy some other things like kitchen utensils or something like that, so he cannot give it, because that person should be a trustworthy person. He is poor, but he has many other things to buy or things, okay?
Yes.
Food, kitchen utensils, household items, okay? So if he's not sure that he's going to buy, to use the money to buy food, then he cannot give money.
Uh-huh.
He should give it in the form of food. And of course, he will eat the food and not throw it away.
I see. Thank you very much, Chobit, for your nice contribution and the answers and comments related to these questions that I ask you of the month of Ramadan and fasting. And you give them and enlighten us by your knowledge. Thank you very much. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT-5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.